ebooks.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Epochs, where we shall be talking all about the Byzantine Empire, the Eastern Roman Empire. And I am joined by Furious Person X, aka Marcus. How are you, sir?
Very good, thank you. Thank you very much, Bo. Much obliged.
Yeah, no.
Good to be back again.
Yeah, great to have you on. We've made lots of content before, and your history of all things Rome, but particularly, or not particularly, but also even the Eastern Roman Empire. Have you noticed that lots of people that know stuff about ancient Rome, classical Rome, sometimes don't have a great knowledge of Eastern Rome? So it's always great for me when you find someone that does.
Yeah, and it's interesting you say that, because one of my favourite documentaries, and arguably like the documentary that led to me on this path as a, you know, as a passion and as a area of study, was 1997 BBC's I, Caesar. And it was a periodic sort of 5-episode series, starting with Julius Caesar, and it ends with Justinian. So the episodes were Caesar, Augustus, Julius Caesar, Octavian, Augustus. Episode 3 was sort of, you know, that period with Claudius Nero, that, you know, because that's sort of a bit of a murky period, obviously.
Did he have Michael Sheen as Nero?
I didn't really have much in the way of actors, more voice acting.
Okay. All right.
Sorry. But no, anyway, and then episode of Hadrian, episode of Constantine. Sorry, it must be 6 episodes then. And then Justinian was the last one.
Right.
And it is narrated by Brian Cox, though, and not the scientist Brian Cox, as in the Scotsman Brian Cox. And he actually does a fabulous job of it. I've never heard the city of Antioch pronounced quite the same way.
Brian Cox, not to be confused with Brian Cox.
Correct, yes. The big, burly Scotsman with the beard, not the, like, ectomorphic, skinny scientist. And it's interesting when you watch the final episode on Justinian, there's kind of a bit of an epilogue at the end, right? And, as you know, after the death of Justinian, the empire waxed and waned, yada, yada, yada. You know, many centuries after Rome fell, Constantinople didn't fall until 1453. It's almost as if, like, an entire millennia of very interesting and, in a civilizational context, quite consequential history is kind of just a 10-minute summary. I appreciate it's not the purview of the documentary, but it's sort of just, it just sort of happened, you know. When Constantinople was captured by the Ottoman Turks, like, well, how did they get there? How did they materialize? You know, where are they from? And so for me, you got to think, 1997, that's when I was very young back then. I've had VHS and DVD copies of the documentary.
Often the way they're like Alaric sacks Rome,
yeah,
and then there is another Rome out east for 1,000 years. But anyway, you often get that,
and it's just like a very a very brief sort of bookend, and there's nothing much to it.
And the more you get into it, you realise what a roller coaster it is.
Oh yeah,
fascinating, and just an endless stream of adventure, ups and downs, crazy stories. It's great,
and also too. And funnily enough, it's something that is referenced in I, Caesar. And I can't remember, I think it's in the Constantine episode, where the sort of part of the narration, they sort of say that one of the things that made the Romans very cynical about Constantine establishing his capital upon the ruins of, upon the foundation of Greek Byzantion, the old city as was. Because even though it was an important city, I mean, Byzantion is referenced in the Peloponnesian War, for instance, it's an important place for Alcibiades to take refuge when he was kicked out of Athens, for instance. Yeah. So you're talking, circa 4th, 5th century BC.
It's mentioned in the Anabasis, isn't it?
Exactly. Because when they pass through when they make their way back from the Black Sea, that's how they get home. Xenophon is 10,000. Constantine, decides upon this place to construct a city. And the point they make in the documentary is, but Romans by this point who live in the East have seen a dozen of these kind of pseudo capitals rise up. Alexandria is a power base, although always remains an important city through this time. Same can be said for Antioch. Antioch is and remains an important power center in the East for, before and after this time period. Galerius is himself based in Nicomedia. As an example.
Yeah, that is a very important city in the ancient world, isn't it?
Exactly. And there are others that, in terms of important provincial capitals, and of these, Byzantion is a relatively minor place. And then sort of Constantine, if you take to the story, marches around what ends up being sort of the Golden Horn. Oh, not the Golden Horn, sorry, but you know, like from the Golden Horn to the
across
to
that the, isthmus.
Across that,
this is the new boundary.
That peninsula with his spear, and you know, puts it in the ground.
Yeah.
And then within what a generation, emperors Arcadius and Theodosius realize that the city's a bit overgrown now, and they had built then the Theodosian walls. But but you know, that's the origin of the city. And again, it's one of those things where it almost astonishes me that there becomes the genesis of something which, as you've referenced, is almost a bookend. It's almost just an epilogue to classical Rome. And I think it deserves a lot more than that, in my opinion.
I think maybe we suffer from Anglosphere bias. I think perhaps if you're Greek or Turkish or anywhere from the Balkans, maybe, I don't know.
Definitely like from the Orthodox sphere, say.
Absolutely, yeah. Then it probably is a bit more in your sort of cultural background, or you're taught it a bit more at school or uni or something.
Mm-hmm.
But where obviously you're an Aussie with Italian heritage, and I'm an Englishman.
Mm-hmm.
We're interested in the Western Rome.
Mm.
Right.
Yeah.
We're interested in like things like the history of Germany and France and Spain and Italy, and like Romania and Hungary and Bulgaria, a bit less so.
Kind of on the periphery.
It's just it's just the way it is, right?
The interesting thing, though, is that you mentioning Italy, is that there is a bit of a distinction as well, because the Southerners, who largely have a, it's probably safe to say that the Southern Italians are sort of an ethnogenesis of Italic Latins and of Greeks. You know, not to get into ancient history, but you know, for a very long time in pre-modern history. What is today modern-day Sicily and modern-day southern Italy, what the Italians call the Mezzogiorno, but the Calabria, Campania, Puglia, etc., were part of this Magna Graeca, part of Greater Greece.
Yeah, right,
and so if you go to towns...
Going back to like the 7th century BC.
Correct.
Deep in antiquity.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like for instance, Syracuse is older actually than, half the Greek settlements in Anatolia, as an example. But if you take away the Ionian coast, of course. But the point I'm making is that, you go to places, for example, like, Messina, you go to places such as, not Amalfi, because obviously a bit more touristy, but say like, I'm familiar with Gaeta as an example. They have an annual Byzantine festival. And they're actually quite sort of, in a way, it still sits in their sort of memory, their cultural memory. Whereas... you go to Tuscany, or you go to Liguria, or you go to Lombardia. It's a different, they're obviously, because they're a bit more, hence the provincial name Lombardia, they're more Lombard. Mm. They're a bit more orientated towards like the Franks and the North Europeans. I mean, and that's fair enough. But what I'm alluding to is in the South, there is that residual kind of civilizational memory of the Greek East and the Byzantine Empire. I mean, let's not forget, Bari falls to the Normans and the Langobards. Around the same time that Manzikert happens.
Right. I mean, well, there's like Belisarius' reconquest of Italy in like, the 6th century.
Mm.
Just the cultural influence of Byzantium, at least in the tiny drips and drabs, makes its way to Scandinavia and Britain.
Mm.
So the fact that reconquered Italy has got like fairly obvious sort of at a glance today Byzantine, Byzantine influences. Yeah, it's sort of not surprising.
Mm.
So it's such a big thing, at least culturally. Okay, if we're going to have this conversation, we thought we'd end with sort of 1204 and the Fourth Crusade, because although everyone who knows their stuff, I've even made content about the Fourth Crusade before, everyone knows that the final Mehmed II conquest is 1453, but people who really know their onions know that really... it was issued with a death blow in some sort of mortal wound in 1204.
Mm.
So hopefully we'll be able
would become a mortal wound, right, at least, yeah.
So we'll try and get our conversation up to that point.
Yeah, yeah.
Where do you think we should even start such a conversation?
Well, you and I sort of thought about, where do we begin this conversation? Do we sort of begin it with the onset of the Macedonian dynasty, the survival of the Arab conquest? And the thing is, if we're talking about the evolution of the state, it's kind of hard to, at the very least, probably start at Heraclius. I mean, we have touched on Justinian ever so slightly.
The very beginning of the 7th century.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when you think of the conclusion of the last Roman-Persian War, it's the first decade of the 600s. And really, because you're in that era, it's sort of hard to ignore what had occurred that previous century with Justinian. I mean, you don't think Justinian's emperor for, over half a century. He's probably one of the most long-lived emperors. I think he died at the age of 86 or something.
A fantastically long reign. And pivotal.
Pivotal. And despite himself having contracted the bubonic plague as well.
A rare survivor of plague.
So,
remarkable. He was like in a coma for a while, wasn't he? And Theodora's like ruling.
Semi-comatose.
It's remarable.
And everyone, like all the Senate and most of the city thought that he was as good as gone.
You would think that, wouldn't you? He's got plague, he's unconscious, end of story.
Sort of in a strange twist of irony, it's actually Theodora who dies relatively young.
He outlives her, doesn't he?
By decades. He's a widower for many years afterwards.
So if we don't actually start the full narrative at Constantine the Great, Constantine the First, in the 4th century, then we have to at least mention Justinian, which we've done. But you think Heraclius is probably a sensible place to actually begin?
Well, I think, and I know, as often happens, because, let's face it, between yourself, myself, and our esteemed friend and colleague, Apostolic Majesty, we have canvassed this topic quite a bit in our circles. And Heraclius does provide a relatively straightforward hinge point in history. When Heraclius the Elder, his father, who's the exarch of Carthage, of North Africa, dispatches his son to depose Phocas, who is himself a usurper against Maurice, Mauricius.
Okay, so there's this Emperor Maurice. There hasn't been a usurpation for like a century. Then he gets usurped by one of his generals, Phocas.
Yes.
Who then in turn is...
Cooed. Yeah, by, you might say, like a patriot faction within the Roman aristocracy.
And so, as a historian looking back, it's really hard not to see either Maurice or certainly Heraclius as this is a nice breaking point. Because you mentioned Justinian rules for a long time. Heraclius rules for a really long time, isn't it? 25 years, it's well over 20 years, isn't it?
Well, you got to think, he's emperor for the last,
or more.
Or almost decade of the Persian War. And then there's almost 10 years before the beginning of the wars with the Caliphate, with the Rashidun Caliphate. And then Heraclius quite tragically lives just long enough to see his eastern conquests lost to the Arabs. The regions he fought so hard for to reclaim from the Sassanids are lost to the Arabs. There's that apocryphal quote when he, I don't know if it's after the Battle of Yarmouk itself or whether it's the retreat from the capital of Syria, which is Emesa. He says, farewell, Syria, for you will be a fine province to the enemy. And I think that summarizes.
So to paint the picture just quickly, you've got like the Byzantine Empire, which is modern Anatolia, modern Turkey. But then beyond that to the east, you've got the quote unquote Persians or the Sassanid Persians. Okay. And so at the beginning of Heraclius's reign, which is the very turn of the 7th century, so the 600s, like the first decade of the 600s. So the Muhammad and his hordes haven't broken out of Arabia at this point. They're not a thing on the world stage at all.
Well, they haven't even had the Ridda Wars yet. If you sort of delve into the nuts and bolts of it, in the midst of the majority of this, the sort of Roman Sassanid period, and certainly the span of the war, Muhammad is a nobody, and then towards the latter period, he's like barely proselytizing. As we know, he bounces between Medina and Mecca. He's kicked out of one city and takes refuge in the other. And so, at this point, and what's sort of particularly diabolical is that this final war is actually cataclysmic for both empires. Just to talk about the hinge point briefly, obviously the empires in the conclusion of the struggle with the Arabs, shorn of a lot of territory, the Romans are forced to reform themselves, as they do frequently in their history. Going all the way back to, I think you and I discussed this last time, if you think of even how the Roman Republic restructured its army, the Polybian Legion, the Marian Legion, going from maniples to cohorts, and the post-Marian reforms, and even, in the imperial period, this tradition still continues in the East, you know, in the East Roman Byzantine army. You know, it evolves actually several times. And also what Heracles does do, and I mean, most people...
Sorry, just quickly say, Maurice is famous for that, isn't he?
Yes.
Maurice is for reforming everything and writing a book about it.
Yes.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. Did he write Strategicon or Tatikia?
Yeah, he's supposed to have done.
Yeah, yeah.
Some people claim he did. Yeah, it says he did. Whether he really did is something else. Yeah. But that's him. Yeah,
because the thing is with this period is that you have to realize that like there's a lot of manuals get written. It's hard to remember who wrote which. You know, Nikephoros Phokas writes one, and you know, there's a few others that get written across time. I think like one of the Botaniates, Scions write ones, or Briennios in the East. I can't remember. But what I'm alluding to is that, and also Heracles from an administrative perspective also transforms or ushers in the period whereby the official language of the empire changes from Latin to Greek. There's a recognition that the majority ethnic group and the governing elite in the East Roman Empire is Greek rather than sort of Latin or Italic. And so therefore Greek becomes the official state language, which for me sort of does provide that sensible, rational idea of the hinge point between what is the old, you know, remnant East Roman part of the Imperial Roman project and what is this new sort of more Hellenic, you know, proto-medieval East Roman Byzantine Empire centered around Constantinople. And that, for me, Heraclius does provide that, and I suppose for most other people who would agree, provides that pivot point.
A lot of their enemies, or even themselves, they call themselves Greeks.
Hellenikoi, yeah.
Yeah, right. And they're speaking Greek, and their enemies often call them Greek. But then also, though, at the same time, they're insisting they are Romans. They're insisting they are the direct, they're the Roman, it's the Roman Empire, and they're the Roman, the Roman Emperor, and all that sort of thing. Because there's a classic history nerds discussion is, is the Eastern Roman Empire Roman or Greek? And I always feel like the answer is, without just being a complete cop-out, that the answer is both. It's a bit complicated.
It's a bit complicated.
It's sort of both at the same time. Well, it depends what period you're talking about.
It's a bit complicated and it's elements of both
in different
ways.
Well, that's the true answer. Because
because the thing is like both. From a standpoint of, say, ethnogenesis and, you know, that topic, right, is that, you know, obviously the Greeks as a populace and as an elite that are present in the empire, you know, they are the majority by some measure. They, you know, they hold power in the cities. They're for the most part the governing elite, with the exception of Anatolia. You know, you have the presence of Armenians and a few other disparate groups, but you know, the language is Greek. You know, the patriarch is a Greek figure who governs essentially over a Hellenized Orthodox, you know, religious, you know, body. And the, you know, medieval Greek is an evolution of, you know, Koine Greek of common classical Greek. And so that's true. So the people who make that point are correct.
Yeah.
But then also, they didn't stop being citizens of Rome, of the empire. The capital moves from Rome to, I mean, Ravenna and Milan, but, you know, it does ultimately move to Constantinople.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Senate relocates from Rome to Constantinople. They don't stop being citizens of that entity. East Rome, as we understand it, is the administrative, political, bureaucratic, governing, and military continuation of that same entity. So to actually have the gall to say they aren't Romans.
It's incorrect to say that.
So really, I feel like both are simultaneously true.
That's sort of the real honest answer.
Yeah.
We hope you enjoyed that video, and if you did, please head over to lotuseaters.com for the full unabridged video.